Maybe you've seen the internet memes. The first rule about CrossFit is to always talk about CrossFit. But when you do, you'll need the right lingo. You never call the CrossFit building a gym, it's a box. Your exercise regime is broadly known as a WOD, workout of the day, and specific WODs have their own names: Fran, Chelsea, Annie, and Isabel. All those insider words make CrossFitters feel like a special breed, different from the people who belong to other gyms, I mean boxes, or just go for a run now and then. And that lingo is part of why some people describe CrossFit as a kind of cult. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Cult is a strong word, and honestly, if you're going to join one, you could do a lot worse than CrossFit. But writer and language scholar Amanda Montell thinks CrossFit is indeed cult-like in the way it uses words to unite its own members and make them loyal to the brand. In fact, Montell says special language is a powerful tool for influencing beliefs and behaviors, in part because it makes us feel special and divides the world into those who are in on the lingo and those who are not. Amanda Montell is host and creator of the Sounds Like a Cult podcast and author of Cultish, The Language of Fanaticism. She joined us in 2021 to talk about it. Amanda, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
We should start by talking about this word cult, which is really not a neutral word. It's so problematic that I know a lot of academics don't use it anymore, even to describe really fringe and possibly dangerous religious sects. What are the main concerns about applying the word cult to particular groups?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a great place to start. And it's the way that my book starts, because the word cult has become so sensational and so subjective that you're right. A lot of scholars of new religions and sociology don't even use it because it's not specific enough to illuminate what dangers may or may not be on the table. The history of the word cult and the way that it's evolved over time corresponds pretty precisely to our culture's relationship with community, spirituality, identity, meaning, and that relationship has gotten pretty fraught, pretty strange. So we think of cults as innately sinister, but that isn't actually the case. This word started long ago in its earliest iteration as a pretty innocent word, meaning homage paid to win over the gods, offerings to please them. And then over time, it evolved to mean sort of a churchly classification alongside religion or sect. It wasn't really until the mid-20th century, when the emergence of so many fringe religions and new religions in the US throughout the 60s and 70s, it wasn't until that time that, you know, old school folks started to get spooked by this movement. And at that point, cults started to gain sort of a nefarious reputation. But it wasn't until really the Manson family murders of 1969 and then the Jonestown massacre of 1978 when the word cult became this national symbol of fear. And now it's often used just as a judgment to trash religions and other ideologically bound groups that the speaker or society at large just don't agree with. So it can be an incredibly charged word. And that's why I tend to ask people to consider more specific language like alternative religion or fringe religion, if that's what they're talking about, or to hedge and call this wide spectrum of groups cultish.
So when you say cultish, what do you mean by that?
That's a great question. I mean, I tend to think of these groups along a continuum. The word cult can be extremely alienating. Nobody wants to be told that they're in a cult or that they have, you know, cult mentality. But if you can hedge the word a little bit and suggest that, you know, cult isn't a name that you're calling someone. Cult isn't this label and it's not a judgment. It's simply this this type of behavior or this type of influence that can imbue spaces we might not otherwise think of as cults, from workout studios, as you mentioned, to social media communities, to multi-level marketing companies, to startups. Cultish influence is everywhere, and all of these groups aren't the same level of destructive, but it can be useful to be aware of these techniques of manipulation because they show up everywhere.
So how did you start thinking about the ways cultish groups and organizations use language in similar ways?
Yeah, great question. Well, I grew up with a cult survivor in the family. When my dad was a teenager in the late 60s, his father forced him to join what is now known as a pretty notorious cult in the Bay Area called Synanon. It no longer exists, not really anyway, but I grew up on these stories of that socialist utopian compound where my dad spent his teenage years. My dad was always very generous with his storytelling, and by far the most interesting parts of my dad's stories were the language, at least to me. There was a ritual that took place in Synanon every single night, this really hostile truth-telling activity where everybody had to gather around in a circle and subject one another to vicious personal criticism. That was called the game, and it was referred to as something you played. Life there was divided into two semantic categories, in the game and out of the game. Kids lived separate from their parents, so you didn't have parents in Synanon. You had PODs, or parents on duty. You weren't allowed to go to school on the outside, so you didn't have teachers. You had demonstrators. And whenever anyone wanted to question a rule or protocol or ritual there, they would be silenced with the phrase act as if, which was an imperative to encourage people to act as if they believed in their leader Chuck Diedrich's beliefs until they did. So I was always really fascinated by the power of this language to create solidarity, encourage conformity, all of those things that a cultish group needs to do in order to gain and maintain power. And then over the course of my life, I noticed Synanon-esque language all over the place, not just in, you know, these really destructive cultish groups, but in the theater program that I was in high school and the startup where I worked in my early 20s and the SoulCycle, you know, classes that all of my friends were taking when I moved to California. So, yeah, I started to notice these elements of cultish language everywhere, and it was really fascinating to be able to explore them more formally for the book.
That also includes, you had a friend who joined AA, and I gather it was good for her, and I'm very happy that that happened, but AA uses kind of this same sort of language.
Yeah, so cultish language doesn't have to be inherently sinister. Again, cults fall along this spectrum, but the idea for this book really crystallized for me when I was speaking to this friend of mine who had recently just started going to AA, and AA has this incredibly robust glossary of special slogans and acronyms and terms, and we all love the feeling of a secret language. I don't know how many listeners grew up learning Pig Latin on the playground, but you feel an instant sense of superiority or insidery when you know how to speak a language that others don't. And at first it seems really harmless because it's invisible. Sticks and stones can break your bones, but words can never hurt you, right? But language can have these really material underlying powers to influence people's behavior, to coerce them. And it's not always equally bad. You know, in the case of my friend joining AA, that sense of solidarity and community that was built with language was really important for her to keep her sober. But sometimes you have a leader at the top who's more than willing to exploit people's innate desires for community, ritual, meaning, and that's when it becomes more destructive.
So some cults can exploit members. I want to be clear on this, though. The idea that cults can get their hands on somebody and brainwash them, that's been debunked by science.
Explanation that the popular media and prevailing wisdom will give for why people wind up in these extreme fanatical fringe groups. But brainwashing is nothing but a metaphor. It's not a real or testable phenomenon. You can't prove that brainwashing doesn't exist, so it doesn't meet the standards for the scientific method. Brainwashing is really just this, you know, form of figurative language. What's really going on are these techniques of conditioning and conversion and coercion, and they have everything to do with language. And I find that it's more useful to think of these techniques of manipulation that way, because brainwashing, again, like the word cult, can be used as a judgment value. Oh, you're brainwashed. No, you're brainwashed. The conversation tends to end there.
So one important thing this language seeks to do in terms of cult-like groups is marking clear lines between us, the group members, and them, which is everybody outside the group. What are some of the ways language can be used to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, having this really extensive lexicon of special words can initially help divide people into an us and a them, those on the inside who know how to use this special language and everybody on the outside who is, you know, not only morally inferior, but intellectually inferior. They don't know these special words. They don't have this special knowledge. But there are also some explicit us versus them labels that many of history's most notorious cult leaders have used to divide us. You know, we as humans tend to like to divide ourselves into, you know, insiders, the good people, and the outsiders, the bad people, because it makes things feel very simple and manageable. So when you have those really strong us versus them labels, those can be extremely emotionally charged and loaded and ultimately quite powerful.
So people who end up tied up in cults, it's been shown they're not less intelligent than the average person, but sometimes they are looking for an identity that they find satisfying. I imagine it's comforting to find a place to fit in rather than continue the search, and cult-like groups are more than happy to welcome you in if you follow the rules.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, right, the myth is that folks who wind up in these groups are desperate, disturbed, intellectually deficient. But interviewing scores of cult survivors and sociologists and psychologists for the book, I realized that the through line is really that these folks are, they're seekers. They're incredibly idealistic. They're service-minded. They believe that the answers to the world's most urgent problems are possible to find, and that this group might hold those answers. And by affiliating with this group, they can access them. That's a pretty optimistic form of thinking. If you're a cynic, or if you're really down and out, you're not going to have the hope or the bandwidth to be able to dedicate yourself to this type of group. And you're exactly right. Right. You know, these cravings for community and connection, they are profoundly human. Our ancient ancestors would gather in groups in their village squares and engage in dancing rituals, even though there was no evolutionary need for that. It just feels good. It lowers our stress. It increases our happiness chemicals. So we really crave those community rituals. Again, it's not inherently bad. It's just when those at the top are exploiting those needs that it becomes dangerous.
Yeah. How does cultist language serve to make members feel dependent on their leaders, which is like the kind of the next step in here, right?
Yeah, of course. So you'll need to emotionally load these buzzwords such that they can be used to threaten folks or coerce folks. So an example that I bring up early on in the book, I was talking to an ex-follower of a group called the Happy, Healthy, Holy Organization. This is a Kundalini yoga group. They own the tea brand Yogi Tea, which can be found in any common grocery store, at least where I live in California. Fun fact. But I was talking to this young woman who had spent a lot of years in this group under, you know, extreme psychological manipulation. And she brought up an example of loaded language that was used in 3HO as the acronym for the cult. It was the word old soul. Now, old soul to an outsider, to an everyday English speaker, is a compliment. You know, it means someone who's wise beyond their years. But within the group, within 3HO, it meant someone who had been reincarnating life after life after life and could never get it right. It was the ultimate threat. It was the ultimate thing that you didn't want to be. And so old soul could be used as a threat to hold over the heads of folks within 3HO. You don't want to be an old soul. You don't want to have Piscean consciousness. You don't want to have a lizard brain. This language doesn't mean much to outsiders, but it was incredibly powerful to those who had been conditioned to believe in it.
So I guess when you hear that used casually in the other context, it's still going to remind you of how your group has decided to use it.
Oh, absolutely. That's the thing about language. It's the first thing that you pick up because, again, it's seemingly innocent and commitment-free, but it's also the last thing that you let go. It really sticks with you. So when I interviewed a member of, or a former member of Heaven's Gate, the infamous UFO suicide cult from the 90s that some listeners might remember, he still referred to his cult leaders from that time as by their cult names, T and Doe. He still referred to death as leaving your earthly containers or leaving Earth, as they were conditioned to call it back in that sci-fi group. So it really sticks with you. And I was talking to a former Scientologist who would tell me that when they're in the wild hearing Scientology terminology, it really does send them right back to that time, which can be painful.
We'll title this tape Planet Earth about to be recycled. Your only chance to evacuate is to leave with us. Planet Earth about to be recycled. Your only chance to survive or evacuate is to leave with us.
That was American cult leader Marshall Applewhite, also known as Doe. He co-founded Heaven's Gate, the group we were talking about before the break that organized a mass suicide in 1997. 39 people died. All right, Amanda, we just heard Marshall Applewhite there, and there's all kinds of terms that he threw in there. I want to get to this idea about, you mentioned it earlier, human bodies were referred to as containers. This certainly seems like a great way to prime people to think their lives don't matter so much, and if they end, it's all to the good.
That's right. He would condition folks with this really elaborate vocabulary that was sort of like King James Bible English meets sci-fi English. You know, this was the 90s. This was a time when digital technology was new to most folks, and some were using it as a way to answer some of humanity's oldest problems. So when you would combine this really familiar sort of Bible syntax with this new and exciting sci-fi terminology, it felt really profound and really exciting for at least a certain faction of people. But yes, when he would use certain euphemisms to paint death as something that was not to be feared but to be embraced, he would actually never refer to it as death. He would exactly refer to it as leaving your earthly containers. This is just a meat suit, an empty vessel. Marshall Applewhite did some incredibly fascinating and haunting things with language. He came up with this robust vocabulary of niche sci-fi-esque terms to match his niche sci-fi-esque creed. There was the severe regimentation of daily life in the mansion where all of these members lived, and the lingo helped keep things in order. The kitchen was called the Nutri-Lab, and the laundry room was the Fiber Lab. Meals were called laboratory experiments. The group as a whole was called the classroom, where followers were students. If they were in the mansion doing things that were important to the group, that was called in craft. If they were outside in the regular world, that was called out of craft. So this was doing real religious work to rhetorically put members in the you know, symbolic place where they could imagine themselves in the world where they wanted to be aboard that spacecraft leaving Earth.
So cults, as we say, are made up of rational human beings who may have lost their way in this regard, but don't stop being people. So another important thing cult language has to do is get in the way of any natural feelings of doubt or disloyalty or dissatisfaction that might crop up among members. Will you explain thought-terminating cliches for us?
Yeah, absolutely. This was one of the most fascinating discoveries of my research process. I want to say first, though, that, you know, there's this interesting thing about rationality. You know, we like to think of ourselves as these rational folks, and that helps us feel empowered. But human beings have all these ingrained biases and irrationalities that prime us to join groups like this. Confirmation bias, sunk cost fallacy, all of these are deeply ingrained, and they're what, you know, they're what are firing a hardcore when you're a member of one of these groups. But thought-terminating cliches, this was a term that was coined in the early 1960s by a psychologist named Robert J. Lifton, and it describes these stock expressions that are easily memorized, easily repeated, and they're aimed at shutting down independent thinking or questioning. So questioning, obviously, is the enemy to any cult, and you need a glossary of these thought-terminating cliches to be able to silence people whenever they try to push back. So some folks, some listeners might be familiar with the group Nexium. It's this cultish group whose leader was just imprisoned. It made news about last year or the year before. And it was a sort of new age self-help scam slash cult. And a thought-terminating cliche that you might hear in Nexium would be something like, well, don't let yourself be ruled by fear, to dismiss valid concerns or dissent, or to frame those valid concerns as limiting beliefs. Thought-terminating cliches also show up in our everyday lives in the form of terms like, you know, well, boys will be boys, or everything happens for a reason. And these phrases are really compelling because they alleviate cognitive dissonance or that uncomfortable discord you feel in your mind when you hold two conflicting ideas at the same time. It's work to think, to question. It's a relief not to have to. And thought-terminating cliches shut down your independent thinking while also letting you off the hook.
So there was this movie back in the late 80s called The Lost Boys, and it was basically about a bunch of sexy young vampires and all the things they did. But in that movie, one of the conceits was that a vampire couldn't get you unless you, like, invited them into your home. And it turns out that the Lost Boys and the psychology of all this have a little bit in common, which is to say that although we think that just being exposed to this kind of language could draw people in, we actually have to sort of want some part of it. We have to be open to it before it can convince us. Is that right?
Oh, that's absolutely right. Yeah, no, language cannot work as some sort of magic spell to brainwash you into believing something that you want on no level to believe. It can only allow you to believe a more and more extreme version of what you already want. So all you need is this glimmer of willingness. And once you want to believe in these messages, which are really compelling, you know, the message that I have the solution to addiction, racism, classism, unhappiness, with that willingness, language can do so much to squash independent thinking, obscure truths, encourage that confirmation bias I was talking to, and emotionally charge experiences such that no other way of life seems possible. But you need that willingness first.
What is the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis?
Oh, well, the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is this nerdy linguistic theory, which says that while language does influence our ability to conceive of ideas, it does not determine it. So that is to say, we are still able to conceive of thoughts that don't match the language available to us. So that is to say, even if you've grown up your whole entire life in a destructive group like the People's Temple, aka Jonestown, or the Children of God, even if that's the only vocabulary you've ever been exposed to, you can still push back in your own mind. You can still have thoughts for which there is no language. And that's a really empowering notion, because even if you find yourself in a toxic situation under cultish influence, whether it's an abusive spiritual group or an abusive cult-like job, even if you don't have the language to put to your experience, you can still push back. You cannot be brainwashed unless you want to be.
So you mentioned the People's Temple. You describe Jim Jones, the founder and leader of that group, as a linguistic chameleon. What do you mean by that?
Well, Jim Jones was, he was an interesting guy, obviously, but he was incredibly well-read and well-studied, and he was motivated by power beyond anything else. So he had this incredible ability to study the oratory techniques of different populist leaders, from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to Father Divine to Hitler. He would pick the most compelling parts of their speech styles and put his own Jonesian twist on them. And then whenever he would speak to someone, he would sort of cater his language according to what they wanted to hear, according to their background, in order to make them feel like he was speaking uniquely to them, in order to make them feel like he was speaking their language. So a linguist might describe this as code switching. He was this very sly practitioner of code switching, or this this ability to switch between multiple language varieties in order to, you know, accent certain spaces, express a certain mood, communicate a certain identity, or in the case of Jim Jones, to connivingly gain trust. So with, you know, Black women who were active in San Francisco's church scene, he would use the familiar timbre of a reverend. But with, white college graduates who were 22 and young, he would quote Nietzsche in order to impress them. So folks would hear what they wanted to hear, and they would tune out the rest.
So this book made me think about the ways that modern politics employs cultish language. I'm thinking about things that sort of hit the culture. You know, the Democrats have things like the war on women and talking about, you know, a small loan of $1 million. Republicans talk about the death tax and the shame of being a rhino, a Republican in name only. You didn't include politics in this book. I wonder if you just thought that would just take another three volumes to properly cover.
Yeah, I mean, there were so many cultish groups that I desperately wanted to cover in this book, but unfortunately, I had to kind of narrow it down. The politics was just a point along the cultish spectrum that I didn't necessarily have the bandwidth to include. It could be its own book for sure. But absolutely, you know, politicians have to use cultish language in similar ways in order to create that us versus them, in order to convince followers that they and only they have the answers to solve these really urgent problems in our culture. And when you find that a politician is using too many us versus them labels, too many thought-terminating cliches, too many charged buzzwords, that might be a sign that their biggest interest is their own power, which I guess you could always argue is a politician's keyest interest. But when they're using this language to get you to shut down your independent thinking and not push back, that's a red flag, because as many of the scholars that I spoke to for this book told me, anything legitimate will stand up to scrutiny.
This is something, the way that language can be used to shape thought and get people on the same page was very familiar to L. Ron Hubbard, who, of course, was the founder of Scientology. I wasn't aware that he actually wrote entire dictionaries of new words for only Scientologists to use.
Oh, yes. He had these incredibly robust dictionaries, not one, but two. One was called the Technical Dictionary. One was called the Admin Dictionary. And together, these volumes contain over 3,000 entries. Some of these were Scientology-specific terms that were brand new. And some of these were loaded language. He would take existing English words and he would imbue them with new Scientology-specific meanings. And that can be incredibly disorienting for people. You know, you've been growing up using the English language this one way for your whole entire life. It helps you make sense of the world. And when this incredibly compelling, charismatic leader is telling you, no, this is not actually what that word means, causing you to question the language you've been speaking your entire life, that causes an incredible amount of internal conflict that we as human beings are innately averse to. And when we feel that level of internal conflict, we default to the nearest confident speaking authority figure to tell us what we need to do to feel safe, what we need to do to feel understood. And so in that way, L. Ron Hubbard was a master of linguistic gaslighting.
All right, I want to shift now to the many places we might be likely to experience cult-like influence with no religion involved. How do multi-level marketing companies use language, first of all, just to draw in new sellers?
Sure. Well, multi-level marketing companies are interesting. Some of us think of them as scams. I think of them as quite cultish. And there are a few reasons for this. I mean, you can look at the list of criteria that would make something cultish, and multi-level marketing groups seem to check off every box. They're these complex, life-consuming organizations with a language and culture all their own. They have these strong and pervasive ideologies that are missionary in character, and members revere their founding leaders who share a desire not just to run a successful company, but to really rule the free world on the level of religious worship. So recruiters at MLMs are trained to what they call love bomb potential recruits with talk of once in a lifetime opportunities, opportunities to become an entrepreneur, your own boss. They'll use this sort of pseudo feminist jargon, boss babe, girl boss, mompreneur, CEO, in order to, you know, imbue people with this sense of idealism, as I was talking about before. If you're a cynic, if you're a skeptic, if you don't believe that the American dream is possible, this language is not going to resonate with you. But multi-level marketing companies are masters at being able to love bomb folks with really highfalutin, lofty promises. And then when this, you know, sort of doomed predatory system inevitably fails, they will gaslight you into believing that if you didn't succeed and become a millionaire in a year, it's not the system's fault, it's your fault. And a group like Amway, which is the biggest multi-level marketing company in the world, they'll have all these charged labels in order to encourage people not to speak ill of the company. People who have negative thoughts or statements to say about Amway are called stinking thinkers. And stinking thinkers are encouraged to be cut out of Amway recruits' lives.
So something that you discovered is that some of these multi-level marketing companies that are aimed at stay-at-home moms and housewives also arm their new recruits with ideas for not telling their spouse or partner who might disapprove.
Oh, that's right. This is a technique that was employed heavily by Mary Kay, I believe. There was something called the Husband Unawareness Program that was written into different manuals and spoken about at recruitment meetings, where if you didn't believe that your husband would approve of you laying down a few hundred or $1,000 in order to buy into this once in a lifetime opportunity, they would use the euphemism "husband unawareness plan" to get you to to sign up in a sneaky way so that your husband wouldn't be aware. So, you know, multi-level marketing companies are masters of these euphemisms. Just think of the terms that recruits are given, the labels that are meant to make them feel empowered. They're not called, you know, employees. They're called things like distributors, coaches, things that make them feel really important. And everybody wants to feel important and like what they do has meaning. And when you feel that way, you're not going to question the person who's filling you with that sense of purpose.
How do they use language to divert attention from the ways their organizations resemble pyramid schemes?
Well, there are certain thought-terminating cliches that multi-level marketing companies will deliver. And it's the sort of thing where once you understand what these things sound like, you won't be able to unhear them. They'll say things like, you know, well, we can't possibly be a pyramid scheme. Pyramid schemes are illegal. As if to imply that just because something is illegal doesn't mean that you can't be involved, even without necessarily knowing that you're involved in this illegal thing. They'll also say things like, well, we're not the pyramid scheme. Corporate life is the real pyramid scheme. And these are really compelling, again, catchy stock expressions that are easily memorized, easily repeated, and can work pretty effectively to shut down any dissent.
Amanda, you actually contend that a lot of multi-level marketing companies are not really so much in the business of selling the products that they portend to sell. What are they selling?
No, I spoke to a behavioral economist for this book named Stacey Bosley, who had some fascinating things to say. She said that these companies are really in the business of the purchase of hope. Sometimes the MLM industry will even acknowledge that what people are really buying is a form of hope. It's part of why MLM recruitment language is so grandiose and hazy and indirect. They avoid the technical terms like investment and employment, favoring aspirational phrases like amazing opportunity and empowering activity. But these sugar-coated words are hiding some really sketchy numbers. 99% of MLM recruits are found not to make any money whatsoever. So really what they're selling is this opportunity, this hope, under the guise of an entrepreneurial business endeavor, and that can be quite predatory.
What happens to people? Is there kind of a common response when they get in and realize the reality is different from what the multi-level marketing organization promised them?
Right. So this is when some of those ingrained human reasoning biases will kick into gear. Confirmation bias. You want so badly to believe that these promises that were made to you will come true. And also sunk cost fallacy. We have this idea that the longer you've been a part of something, the longer you should stay. And they want people, they want recruits who have that, you know, ability to stick it out even when things are rough. And they'll hit you with phrases like, you can't give up now. You'll be giving up on your family, on the American dream itself. So a lot of the time people will deny to themselves that that these promises were not fulfilled, and they'll stick it out, especially because they're being vehemently promised that if they just hold on for another month, try harder, dedicate themselves more, be the boss babe they really are, then those promises will be fulfilled. And you often find in a similar way to folks who've been involved with toxic one-on-one relationships, who find themselves going from one abuser to another, multi-level marketing recruits will not find success with one, but then want to try another in hopes that maybe this time they'll be fulfilled. So what toxic relationships and cults have in common, it's really surprising. So many of the same features. If you've ever had a relationship with someone who abused you, even if it was a one-on-one relationship, you can imagine pretty accurately what it would feel like to be involved with a cult.
Are impulsive people more likely to get wrapped up in cult-like organizations?
You know, impulsive folks, that behavioral economist Stacey Bosley, what she told me was that impulsiveness might make you more susceptible to fraud, to, you know, signing up initially for a pyramid scheme. But I wouldn't say that impulsiveness would make you more likely to join, or more importantly, stay for years and years in a cult. That has more to do with, again, that overabundance of hope and idealism, the faith that if I just stick this out a little bit longer, those promises will be fulfilled.
So I recently bought a lipstick that was described in a magazine as a new cult favorite. We should say that some businesses do not mind being referred to as having a cult-like following. What is the sort of alternative understanding of that term these days when it's used for marketing purposes?
Well, I was talking earlier in the hour about how the word cult didn't really gain its truly sinister undertones until the Manson murders of 1969 and the Jonestown massacre of 1978. But of course, as soon as cults became terrifying, they also became cool. And it didn't take long for 70s era youth to birth slang terms like cult followed and cult classic to describe indie movies and bands and that sort of thing. And now, as our relationship to community, spirituality, identity, has gotten weirder and weirder over time, this word cult can apply to anything from a political group to a truly destructive fringe religion to, as you said, a makeup brand. And that says a lot about the cultishness that appears in our everyday lives. Now, we as conversationalists are pretty savvy at picking up the stakes whenever a word is invoked in casual conversations. So when a brand uses cult followed to describe their product as a marketing term, we know pretty automatically that the possibility of, you know, true physical isolation, death and destruction, that's not really on the table. But this wide spectrum of uses of the word cult really says something about our society today.
How does a company like SoulCycle use the coolness of cults or cult followings anyway to its advantage?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as our sites of community and connection become increasingly less religious over time, which religious scholars have found that our culture is becoming not really more secular, but more spiritually eclectic. Some folks call spiritual practitioners in the 21st century the remixed, because our spiritual practices are so mix and match, you know, a horoscope in the morning, Shabbat in the afternoon. You know, we have so many ways of engaging spiritually now. And fitness, cult fitness, if you will, has become one of those really popular sites of spirituality and community. And SoulCycle knows, you know, as a sort of business strategy, that when you can manufacture a sense of spiritual transcendence within a studio, tightly bonding folks within that studio together, that becomes great for return business. So SoulCycle has this incredibly intense training process where they will recruit instructors, not from gyms or personal training, but from performers, influencers, folks who have the charisma to command an audience. And they put them through this training where they learn how to cultivate a cult following of their own language, their own culture, so that when you're on the bike with the good smelling candle and the dark lighting and the mantras and phrases literally embossed on the walls around you as you're cycling for your life, and you're hearing these phrases like, you can ride to overcome your greatest obstacles, you know, you are strong, you are beautiful, you are perfect. It becomes really religious in a sense.
And I mean, are SoulCycle instructors taught to operate like clergy members?
In a sense, you know, I spoke to several SoulCycle instructors who were talking about how they are trained to create this sort of following where they're blurring the boundaries really between fitness instructor, best friend, lifestyle guru, spiritual leader. It's really interesting the role that these folks are playing in their followers, in their students' lives. And, you know, in a SoulCycle class, it's not just about your body or your flat abs or your taut behind. It's really about that sense of transcendence. And these individual instructors are encouraged to build individual cult followings of their own.
We are, Amanda, in a really interesting place where you don't even have to physically meet someone who's involved in a cult-like organization. You just brought up QAnon. Lots of people's only sort of exposure to the group has happened through their digital screens.
That's exactly right. You know, cults we think of as these groups that exist on remote communes in the woods somewhere. We don't think of them as existing online on social media platforms. But, you know, QAnon has shown that you don't need a physical location in order to assemble, in order to radicalize. And of course, when you're online, the only medium with which you have to communicate ideology to radicalize is language, even as something as simple as a hashtag can be incredibly powerful at galvanizing these cult followings.
Is there a way that we can get the good out of organizations that employ cult-like language without finding ourselves in a place where we're in deeper than is healthy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I am by no means encouraging people to disaffiliate from these profound sites of community and connection. only to be aware of the cultish language techniques that might signify that you're in a group that is too cultish for comfort. So one of my favorite conversations while researching the book was with an ex-Jonestown member, so one of the most notorious cults of all time. And she told me that over the years, trying out so many different forms of communal living, she ultimately determined that the way to keep her safe while also engaging in those spiritual practices was to become a member of multiple different cults. So there's no one size fits all. There's no one group that's going to fulfill all of these promises. It's just not realistic. So she said, you know, I tried Jonestown. She actually also was a member of Synanon, the group my dad was in. So she really gave cults a good old college try. But in the end, she said, you know what? I need to get my fulfillment from multiple different sites. I'm going to become a Quaker. I'm going to become an immigrants' rights activist. I'm going to meditate in this different group. And so in that way, you're sort of diversifying your social and spiritual portfolio instead of putting all your eggs in one basket, because any group that's legitimate will allow you to participate casually so that you can get your spiritual fulfillment in that place and then step out of it and return to your normal life. The word sacred literally means to set aside. So we need to be able to set aside our spiritual practices and return to our normal lives and our normal identities, which are more complex than any individual group and what that can give us.
Do you mind if I ask how your father broke free of that cult that he was brought into by his parents?
Oh, absolutely. So my dad's story is so interesting. I mean, he broke the rules while he was there, and he wasn't supposed to attend an outside school, but he hitched a ride into San Francisco every single day in order to attend an accredited high school so that he could get a real diploma and leave and go to college. So as soon as he graduated from that high school, he had his diploma in hand. He applied. He had no idea what the college process was like because he was so isolated from the outside world. But it was 1973. He applied to two colleges, the two nearest ones to where he was living. He got his UC Berkeley acceptance letter first. So he matriculated at UC Berkeley. Then he went to grad school, got his PhD in neuroscience, and now he's a world-renowned research scientist. I'm very proud of him.
That was my conversation from 2021 with Amanda Montell, host and creator of the Sounds Like a Cult podcast and author of Cultish, The Language of Fanaticism. If you enjoyed this show, check out our conversation with Andy Norman, director of the Humanism Initiative at Carnegie Mellon University. He joined us to talk about how conspiracy theories can corrupt our thinking and how we can fight back. You might also like our show about Esperanto and why, despite its creator's best intentions, it is not the global lingua franca. That was with Princeton professor Esther Shore, author of The Bridge of Words, Esperanto and the Dream of a Universal Language. All of our podcasts are on our website, think.kera.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.